sit back and get ready to take off with Dynamic Golf. So welcome back, Dynamic Golf listeners. I'm your host, Tim McElvanna, and with me is my fellow co-host, Sean Klotz. Sean, who's our guest today?
Hey, T-Mac, and hey, Dynamic listeners. I feel like this is a really good get. I say that a couple times throughout our times we've been doing this, but Phil O'Neill is a club president up at Oakley Country Club, and I've known Phil for basically about 6 months now. I feel like we're lifelong friends because he's just got a great personality. Phil, just kind of introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe give us a little background of kind of where you came from, what you've been doing.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
You got 50 minutes to fill. So.
Sean, thank you. Thank you, T-Mac. Pleasure to be here with Sean. We're at Oakley Country Club here in the Boston area. As Sean mentioned, my name is Phil O'Neill. I am currently the president of Oakley Country Club. Not from the area originally. Born and reared in Ireland, in the southeast originally, and then we family moved to the northwest, which is where I was introduced to golf. But, came to the U.S. in the late 90s for work. Kind of a cliche, really, came for a year. And
stay for life.
25 years later, we're still here. So it's been wonderful. It's been just wonderful. We've enjoyed every minute of it. It's we've been very fortunate that we had the opportunity to come to the U.S. And, we've had three kids. Born here. We've been in the Boston area the whole time.
Kind of a golf family, right?
Very
essential. Yeah. Connor plays, Kate plays.
Yeah, Yigal has taken it up. My wife in the last few years. Laura can play, but doesn't necessarily enjoy it as much. Okay. But I very fortunate. I mean, I think for us all to be in the game of golf. My dad got me into golf when I was about 13.
How many times do we hear that, Tim?
A lot. Right about the age of 13. 10 to 13 is about the big golden age.
It is. I was actually in Ireland at that time, so we're talking early 80s, Sean and T-Mac, and it was, so it was very much a men's game.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of ladies playing, and there wasn't a lot of kids. Okay. Kids were supposed to be seen and not heard.
Okay.
I tell my kids that all the time. They don't listen, though.
So, I picked up a sport, a head injury playing football, and so I had no, I was given a mandate, no contact sport for a year, so I headed out to the golf course with my dad and very quickly kind of picked up the game and just fell in love with it and have played ever since, and...
You play like on a collegiate level, sort of? It's
a little bit different. The high school scene in Ireland is a little bit more like the collegiate scene in the US.
Okay.
College golf, so there's really, at the time, there was only like five universities in Ireland, so there wasn't a lot of schools, and hence there wasn't really the ability to have any kind of competitive league.
Okay.
So college golf was not huge in the 80s growing up. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, junior golf wasn't huge. So if you were able to kind of play and progress, you could represent your club, you could represent your province, you could represent your country, But at high school, we ended up with a really strong golf program and a great bunch of guys. We won like five national championships in our high school years, three five-man teams and three man teams. The three-man team is actually a World Golf event. So I don't know if you're familiar with the World Golf Federation.
Mm-hmm.
It was a kind of global junior golf program. And they held world championships, which we qualified for. I played in 1987 in Fox Hills in Surrey, England. And that was a really good experience. It was 4 days of medal play and a really tough course. Actually, the European Q School used to be held at Fox Hills, and David Fogarty tells a great story. He said if they hadn't moved the Q School out of Fox Hills, he would never become a pro because he couldn't break 80. So college then is a bit of a lot of good kids.
Yeah.
So at that time, Darren Clark was in the program. He was a year older than I was. Porrie Carrington's a year younger than I am.
Wow.
So we were right in that mix, you know.
Wow.
And so a lot of those kids took a break after high school, you know, a year or two to try and focus on amateur golf.
Yep.
You know, again, you know, you had to be lucky enough to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't. I went straight from high school to university, and
yeah,
kind of golf took a bit of a backseat, you know, from, you know, that.
Did you know, or any regrets in your world? Like, did you know, like, that you maybe weren't as top notch as Darren Clark, or was it more about resources type of thing?
I would put it simply, and if Clark was here, I mean, he was the most talented amateur.
Yeah.
In Ireland by far.
Okay.
Right. He was so naturally gifted, you know,
yeah,
ball striking was incredible. And so he was on that path.
Yeah.
But, you know, others like my very good friend Francis Howley, who's now the head pro at Portmarnock in Dublin,
okay,
which is a wonderful, wonderful golf course and facility.
Yeah.
Francis turned pro.
Yeah.
You know, he got his tour card same year as Porrick got his, Porrick Carrington.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I, you know, I was close enough,
yeah,
you know.
Competitive.
Yeah. I mean, I was in toe-to-toe with Francis for,
right,
for the, you know, the years of, like, yeah, 14 to 19 type,
okay,
thing.
Okay.
And, but the opportunity wasn't there. And it wasn't encouraged. It wasn't promoted. Yeah. Like, the European Tour was, I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of money in the game back then.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you were coming out of high school, it was like, do you want to be a doctor or a priest? Those were the two questions you were asked in Ireland.
Yep.
And you know, so golf wasn't really on the menu. You
yeah.
know, it wasn't an option right. per se. So, but you know, that's how I got into the game, and that's how I grew to love it. And then you know, came to the US and for work, and you know, and my wife's Irish as well, so she came over with, we were just married, and then, you know, you start a family and you're busy and stuff like that. So,
yep.
You know, I played around the Boston area, you know, tournaments, invitational, charity events, that type of thing. And then in 2010, somebody said, hey, you should look into joining Oakley. And
okay.
So yeah. I came up for a practice round and, you know, had a great day. And then they were offering, you know, a trial program for new members. I jumped on that and
yeah.
and then kind of became a full member on January 1st, 2011. Yeah. And it's been wonderful. It's a T-Mac, you know, I'm sitting here with Sean, as we said, but
yeah.
it's the first Donald Ross course. We celebrated our 125th last year.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So Ross came over from Dornoch in Scotland, and his first job was Oakley Country Club. And, he, you know, and he's gone on to design and build
a good career, right?
A pretty good career. So we're very proud of that. And, you know, we could do a better job letting people know that this is the first Ross course,
mm-hmm.
but I think we've started to get better at that. But really, I think what makes Oakley special for me, I think, and most of the members, is just the membership and the people here.
Yeah.
It's not your typical country club culture. You know, people are super friendly, super nice, engaging. You know, you just feel welcome, I think, yeah. when you come to Oakley, regardless of who you are or what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the special.
Yeah.
Special sauce, you know, for Oakley here. You know, the course obviously is spectacular. You know, it's not long. It's you know, but it's a true Ross course in terms of the green complexes. You know, some of the Irish amateurs I spoke about there now have come through here from time to time, and they're like just absolutely terrorized by our green complexes. You know? And these are all like really good golfers, so it's
It stands up.
Yep. It definitely does. It really, yeah, it does, Sean.
For 125-year-old golf course.
Yes.
Yeah.
It stands up over time. Tim, I think you should be like an honorary member after what we've done this summer with our interview and our.
Well, I was gonna say, you know, Phil is you know, I think he's definitely right. Every member that I've talked to on this podcast has been very warm, opening, and welcoming. I've worked at private facilities. I've met the presidents and the board members, and they're not usually very friendly or very open to people. And it's very unique, and you can tell that it's a very special place that you guys have there. You got a little piece of heaven right there.
We do with
everybody that you know is welcoming to come on here and talk to us and everything. You've got a great facility right there.
I think the thing is the pride, Tim. So now I'm kind of like starting to become the insider. You know, at the beginning of the summer, I was the outsider guy, and I'm starting to become kind of the part of the inside crew, whatever, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And, there's pride in every member you talk to. You know, they're appreciative. That's another term I would use for the membership. Know what they've got, you know, and it does. It just takes them, you know, go to a couple different golf courses in the area, and you realize the dedication the superintendent has, the dedication the Greens Committee chairman has, kind of like directing, and the board, directing the superintendent. It's a really good team atmosphere. And like you talk about, T-Mac, and we're not going to name names on courses in the Tampa area. We could. No. Private facilities that you feel like you're an outsider all the time when you walk in. But this one is, this one's different. When you walk into the parking lot, you know, the goal is essentially that you don't touch your bag, that you feel like you're a guest for the day if you are a guest.
Yeah.
And then that typically has led to probably many memberships in the past too.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They feel that experience they have.
Yeah, they really do. I mean, no, and you're very kind. I mean, I think it is all of that, you know, Oakley is all of that. And you know, and our location as well, we're right here in, you know, right. See the city. We can see the city right now, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's you know, we're a short spin into downtown Boston, and you know, and I think, you know, we're starting to see a lot of new young members, you know, who are working in the city, see how easy it is to shoot up Sturro Drive and get to Oakley in a few minutes, and that's really starting to help the club and position the club to be, you know, really in a strong position for years to come, and both in terms of the membership and the families that, you know, come with the new members as well.
That's great.
It hasn't always been that way, right? So
no.
Talk to me, like, from 2010 to 2024, wasn't there a period of time when you guys were looking for members and kind of?
We had I mean, you know, I'm sure every club has similar story, but so from, you know, 2010, I mentioned the trial program. That was an initiative to try to encourage people to come and, you know, try out the course without having to put down, you know, any significant money.
Was that literally, I don't want to interrupt.
No.
Was that literally like 2008 real estate boom kind of goes down?
Yes, it was. It really was. Yeah. And, you know, and there was another couple of factors. It was funny, you know, when I was interviewed for the to become a member, you know, at the club, you know, one of the selling points from the membership committee was how great the greens were, right? But when you went back out to play the greens, they were not great.
Okay.
They were actually really bad.
Okay.
And so the course, we had a superintendent at the time, you know, names won't be mentioned, but, you know, the course was not in good shape. And members were not happy. Members were not new members were not joining, I think, as a big result of that. And you know, that's when we got our new superintendent. That Pat joined in 2012, I think.
Yeah.
And he just turned the place around. And you know, the course became just pristine.
Yeah.
People really kind of, you know, started to recognize, wow, it can really be like this, you know. And
level of expectation.
Yeah.
Now, right.
Yeah.
Like. Again, T-Mac, as we talk, and we're, you know, 8 miles from downtown, or not even 8 miles, 5 miles from downtown Boston, you know, there's a level of expectation that kind of the membership has and sort of the people have around this area.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some pretty stiff competition as far as private
facilities. Absolutely.
The country club.
Winchester.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you can keep going a little. We can keep going a little.
Oh yeah.
Well,
yeah,
you got a lot of money in that area. You've got a lot of prestige in that area, and you've got to build your product to match what you're looking for, I would imagine.
Yeah. And that is a great. That's a super point, Tim, because I think as well, you know, you know, the game of golf and the golf industry and country clubs are evolving all the time and changing. And if you don't recognize that, and if you can't move and change and evolve with that, you're gonna hit a few bumps.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think, you know, so much of it has to do with getting the right people involved. People who really have, I mean, you know, we're lucky again because we have so many members here that really love this place. Yeah. And they're so generous with their time. Yeah. They volunteer so much of their time to, you know, be it on committees or,
redesigning simulator rooms.
Yeah. It's like, it's endless. It goes on and on. But you know, getting the right group of people together at the committee level, and then even more importantly at the board level, is just so important.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have people who really understand what's going on and how the club needs to evolve, how you make the changes to stay relevant and keep pace in a city like Boston, you know, you can get behind really quickly.
Yeah.
You know, things can go sideways pretty quickly. So I think that's really important.
How do you, so talk to us about, again, kind of like from that, we can use Oakley as the footprint, no question about it, from becoming the club president.
Yeah.
Like, is there a, your vice president first type of thing? Because you almost need that training to see it, right?
It really is. I mean, there's a, you know, it's so, you know, you really, in order to do the job, in order to be a board member first, you really have to know the ins and outs of the workings of a facility of an organization like Oakley, right?
Yep.
Or any country club, right?
Yeah,
everybody, you know, you have your, it's like a business.
We could be talking about any country club, and that's what
you have your, you have your systems, your policies, your staff, you know, all your nuances, and you really need to understand how the place functions and takes over to be on the board, and then even more so to be president.
Yeah.
So how it works here is, you know, you volunteer to join a committee. I became golf chair, and I joined a golf committee, and then I became golf chair.
Okay.
And then from golf chair, I was, you know, asked, and it's a huge honor, obviously. Yeah. You know, it's really the president and vice president's prerogative to pick the next president and vice president.
Okay.
When I say pick, I mean nominate. Okay. And you know, and then, you know, they're put forward to the nominating committee. The nominating committee then votes on who they believe is the best person for a job.
Yeah.
So there is a full process there, and every stage of that is very important.
Yeah.
So once you're asked, you're vice president for 2 years, and then you take president for 2 years. So 2 year terms, and then you lead the board. And so you do have to think carefully about your board and your committees, because you want the right people cycling through.
Yeah.
And you can't just, you know, ask, you know, Pat down in the bar, hey, do you want to be president next?
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't work like that. And you need the knowledge, you need the institutional knowledge to really be able to do the job effectively, you know?
So would you say, Phil, that in your time that you've been there, you've seen not just a change in the membership, but also a change in the training program from, you know, one stage to the next? Have you seen a lot of passion in that? I take it. It seems like that they're working hard on how to train the next, you know, president, vice president, so on and so forth.
Yeah. It's, to a certain extent, that's right, T-Mac. I think the big thing, like in so many things, it's all about the people, and, you know, the country club needs great staff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think that's really something that we have focused on in the last number of years, you know, so, you know, like people like Sean here, you know, we need more people like Sean. We look for the talent that's out there, because that's what's really going to make the difference. Like, we need, you know, at the end of the day, we're hiring professionals, whether it's golf professionals, whether it's superintendent, greenskeepers, you know, groundskeepers, but also clubhouse manager, you know, executive chef,
right,
the kitchen staff, the bar staff, the service staff.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all professional people who we rely on to do a great job, and they just do a wonderful job.
Right.
And I think in years gone by, that wasn't always the case,
okay.
you know, yeah. and
the continuity of having Pat and Scott just from the
incredible, incredible
just from the golf side. It's, it shows through the product.
Yeah. And just, you know, you have to recognize that and do the right thing. Like make it easy for these guys to stay here. Hmm. Make it easy for our staff to stay. They want to be here. They like the job. It's rewarding. It's challenging. They're well compensated. Like that's, you know, that's what you have to do, especially in a competitive market like Boston, where like you've got, you know, a dozen clubs, T-Mac, within like a 20-minute drive, you know, and it's, you know, so I think recognizing some of that, T-Mac, is really important. And, you know, finding people, good people, and then keeping them. And then they start to, as you mentioned, train other staff, other members, bring people up to speed.
Right.
It's a constant process. And I think the other big thing is communication, you know, trying to be transparent with as much as you can with the membership about what we're doing, where the club is going, how the club is, you know, is it financially sound? You know, what are the big projects we're going to spend, you know, the money on, you know? So, cause again, we're all owners. You've got 340 bondholders, everybody's an owner. And so I think it's important to be as transparent as possible. You know, you can't go through everything, but, you know, we try to do that as best we can. And those are some of the, I think, things that have, I think, helped the club. And, you know, we're pretty healthy now. We've got a good waiting list across our member categories. You know, so.
Great. Good mix, too. You know, kind of like the juniors.
Great mix.
Juniors,
yeah.
T-Mac, we call juniors kind of that 24 to 32, 33-year-old type of thing.
Okay.
And those guys are, you can just tell they're kind of the next sort of batch or recruits, we'll call them, of who.
It is without a doubt the fastest growing group right there in the game of golf right now. The 24 to 30 year olds, they are just coming on strong, and a ton of them. And they have wealth. You know, they're not like us back in the day. You know, we couldn't get two nickels to rub together, but these kids have, you know, high prominent jobs and income to dispose of. And they are the highest group of golfers coming out right now.
Yeah, no question about it. We see it here, Tim. I mean, the number of applicants in that age bracket is off the charts, and it's something we're kind of acutely aware of and trying to see how best to manage that going forward.
While also keeping the legacy people, the guys who've been supporting the club
100%.
Right,
we're very very focused and you know, have been and hopefully will continue to be take the right steps when it comes to protecting the legacy members and legacy member families as best we can, you know, and I think that's really important, you know,
so T-Mac, one of the things you just kind of touched on, I don't even know if you meant to touch on it, but like these younger generation, and it's ladies and men, by the way,
it's not just men.
Very successful 25 to 35 year old ladies that I know that are kind of becoming part of the club too. They're coming from colleges and universities. I mean, one of Boston's biggest economic imprints or footprints is the universities and the colleges around here.
Yeah.
Right. So they're from, again, BU, BC, they're spending $60,000 to $80,000 a year to go to these schools.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when they come out, they're getting jobs that are, you know, ideally $75,000 to $200,000 jobs, whereas a little different than our Tampa world, where, you know, university is not—it's not even negative. It's just kind of the way it is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, University of Florida's 2 hours away. Florida State's 4 hours away. You know, University of South Florida is right there, but it's just different, the economic factors that go into.
And South Florida is more of a suitcase college too. So, you know, you don't have those kids staying around. As soon as college is gone or class is gone, they're back to wherever it is, Miami or Orlando or wherever it is.
Yeah. Right. Like Phil's saying, like these kids that we're talking about, these are generational kids. Like their grandfathers, their great, they've lived in Winchester, Belmont, you know, Watertown, Brookline.
Yeah.
They've lived here for generations. Florida, that Tampa area, you know, what, a house is old if it's 1960, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
it translates to the oldest golf course that we know of is in Clearwater, right? Or St. Pete. Hopefully it's still there. Bel Air.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a 1918. Totally different than our courses up here. So
Correct. It just translates the membership. It kind of, you see it in different parts of the operation.
Well, the history up there, I mean, it's just so much richer. Yeah. It's deeper. I mean, you've got, I mean, just littered with prose and history, and that just breeds and feeds, you know, younger generations and traditional golfers, you know, family golfers throughout the time.
Ireland, though, does it remind, like, does it part of remind you of Ireland?
Oh yeah, right? It definitely does. It definitely does. I mean, I think, you know, golf is, you know, huge in Ireland now, obviously. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, it's so different than it was back in the late early 90s. Yeah. It's taken off. It's, you know, they've got, it's more like it is here now than it was
the exposure.
Like, yeah, the exposure
now,
and the,
now what's the
access,
the thing you said before, like our kids, our juniors, our ladies, much more acceptable.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's night and day. Right. Yeah. Okay. It's night and day. I mean, yeah absolutely. You know, it's, you know, as I said, just the access, the availability, the quality of the golf courses. I mean, you know, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like one of the good, like growing up there, you just took it for granted. Yeah. You were walking, you know, you're playing your Strand Hill, Ross's Point, you know, Enniscrone, those are, of course, around. They're all like, top 100 really? Courses are just amazing. You know, true links golf.
Yeah.
And you would go out and play, and you would be the only person on the course, you know, and it was just a different time. But you know, it was, looking back, it was pretty special to be able to do that and play those courses, because now it's like, it's so different. And, right. and now, you know, unfortunately as well, the downside of the exposure and that, how they've marketed what they have, which is amazing.
Right.
But green fees and things like that are getting really expensive, you know? Yeah. I mean, we used to play a lot of junior underage, you know, with the Irish Cup panel and teams in La Hinch, West Course. It was like 4 weekends a year in La Hinch. We would turn up and get coached by, it was John Gardner first, then it was David Jones. You know, but like, and it's a wonderful spot, but now it's €400 now to play La Hinch.
Oh, wow.
Right, yeah. it's right up there with, you know, I don't know what Pebble Beach is these days, but it's
like 800 or something.
But you know, it's that's the other side that's gone with it. But still, they're obviously, the courses are busy now. They're packed. Right. They're doing really well, which is great, because you know, now those courses are able to kind of put some money back into the facility, the clubhouse, the course, and you know, keep that whole thing, you know, at the level it should be, you know?
Is it kind of getting to the point, so Scott Johnson, you know, T-Mac and listeners, Scott Johnson's our head professional here, been here for 24 years, just an amazing guy.
Great guy.
He just booked the trip down to Pinehurst.
You know,
But the thing is, T-Mac and listeners, he's not playing Pinehurst.
No.
Because there's so many golf courses
around there
that are worth playing. So kind of the same idea, like, yeah, you might go to Old Head in Ireland, but how many great golf courses are right around it.
Exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly the same thing. You might, you know, the ones in Ireland obviously that stick out, or, you know, Old Head is a you know, more of a recent addition, but you know, Portmarnock in Dublin is just special.
That's where Ross came from.
Ross came from Dornoch.
Sorry.
In Scotland.
Okay. Yeah.
And then obviously Roy County Down, which is just obviously amazing. It's always hitting the lists.
British Open.
You know, the British Open was held in Roy Port Rush, which is not far away, in the northern part of the country.
Okay.
That was interesting, because, you know, it's Northern Ireland, and the British Open was being played there, so it was kind of a first in a long, long time.
Okay.
And it's there again next year.
Okay.
Wow.
So it's it. Yeah. So they're going back to Roy Port Rush, which will be great. It was a great open. It's the one that Lowry won.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Lowry.
Oh, God.
So, which was a pretty special. But it's.
Have you played with him at all? Or
no, Lowry's younger. Yeah. I know what Shane is now. Maybe he's like himself and McIlroy are, I think, 36, 37.
Right around there. Yeah.
I mean, big fan of Lowry, big fan of his game, big fan of his attitude. He's a fun guy, it's like that, Sean. There's so many good unknown courses that you can. I think that's the beauty of it, right? You go to play the ones you've heard of, like Tralee, Ballybunion, But then around the corner, there's Dukes and there's all these other great courses that are maybe not like getting headline, but they're really great tracks and fun to play, you know? And it's, so Ireland is definitely, they've definitely really figured out the whole, the golf destination / you know, trips for sure.
Good.
You know?
Now, Phil, let me ask you, as a kid growing up, I've heard some of the great golf courses that you've had. Who are some of the great influences for your golf game?
So I think at the time, T-Mac, good question. So, I mean, I'm not sure if these names will resonate, but, you know, Chrissy O'Connor.
Yeah.
Chrissy O'Connor Sr. was like a real ambassador for Irish golf. He was really great player back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, early 50s. And then his nephew, Chrissy O'Connor Jr.
I think that's the one I remember.
Yeah, so you'll remember the 2-iron he hit into the belfry in the Ryder Cup,
mm-hmm.
Which was like, you know, this incredible 2-iron the last hole of the Ryder Cup to beat the U.S. for, you know, I mean, you know, I think like the U.S. had won maybe 39 Ryder Cups in a row.
Yeah.
Before. Oh my gosh.
Pretty one-sided.
You know, before Europe started to kind of figure it out, but it's but he was a big influence, Chrissy O'Connor Jr. And then you went on to have people like Des Smith, you know, Ferdy himself was a great player. I think he won 6 times in Europe. Okay. He's a really good player. Yeah. You know, so those were the influence at the time. And obviously, you know, being closely aligned to England as well, you were the Nick Faldos of the world and the Howard Clarks and these guys. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, in Ireland, those would have been the influences, T-Mac. You know, those were the guys. And then you had your own, you know, you had the pro at your own club, you know. Our pro was Brian Malone. He had a pretty good amateur career, pretty good professional career, you know, before he ended up at Strandhill in Sligo.
Okay.
So
was your dad a decent player?
Yeah, he's probably like a 7 or 8 handicap. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah,
he did for work. Sure.
He was. So my dad was. How we ended up. So I was born in Wexford, southeast of Ireland, and then my dad changed jobs. So he was in agricultural science.
Okay.
So he was involved in land reclamation projects, initially for the government and then for a private company. So in Ireland, the west of Ireland, the land is not great. So from an agricultural perspective, it's kind of wet and stony and not as fertile as the east coast or certainly the south.
Okay.
So he worked for a company in Sligo that did a lot of land reclamation projects.
Right.
So that's why we moved.
Okay.
And I moved just like kind of finishing elementary school, going into high school around that time. I was like 10, 11.
Yeah.
So that's how we ended up in the Northwest.
Yep.
And you know, and that's how
big soccer fan or
you know, there's, you know, we're the Irish sports, your curling and football, which would have been the primary sports in, you know, growing up in school, you know, in your town, local teams. Soccer was big, equally big.
Okay.
Rugby at the time wasn't as big, but now it's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, but sports was huge. I mean, the schools, you know, they'd grown up in Ireland, sport was big.
Right.
You
right.
know, yeah. And, you know, a lot of the schools in Ireland at the time were, you know, there was convents. So the girls would go to the convent and then the boys would go to an all boys school.
Okay.
So that even made it more kind of the focus and attention to sport and competitive sport was huge. Wow. But again, football, hurling, soccer, not so much golf. Well, the golf in our school became huge in secondary school, but and then there's there was a very good competitive national program or league, like annual tournament, you know.
No.
T-Mac, I got a question I'm going to ask you first.
Okay.
And then it's going to lead to a question for Phil.
Okay.
So you got 2 daughters, is that correct?
Yes, sir, that I know of.
Give me their ages again, because they were like little when I was there, but now they're old, I think.
I've got one that's 2 and one that's 5.
There you go.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
the 5-year-old I've been seeing on YouTube a little bit swinging with you?
Yep. She's been swinging a little bit, getting her into the game of golf. I'd started her at about age 2, so she's been swinging since about 3. And I've got the younger one, swinging too.
Love it. Love it. So my question to you, and it's going to be coming to Phil here in a second, is kind of, because I see him working with his kids, or I see him playing with his kids. His kids are great that I know. I know Connor and Kate really well. Don't know Laura as much. Haven't seen her as much. But what kind of, like, you know, maybe general again, but like what tips, what are you going to tell the youngsters, the 5-year-old, the 2-year-old, like what are the major things that you kind of try to get them to start doing, even at that age? And then again, Phil's kids are a little bit older. My girl's a little bit older, but sort of, you know.
Really, the big thing I do at that age is I just try to get them to stand correctly and hold the club correctly at that point. You know, at age 5 and you know, 2, I'm just trying to get them into the position. They always want to hold it with their left hand low and swing it that way. So getting them to kind of reverse that a little bit, and then just getting them to stand square to their target line. At this age, I just want them to swing the club and have fun. If they're laughing and having fun, then we continue on. But once they start kind of, you know, getting tired, it's pull it back and let's find something else, some other activity to do.
I love it. What do you worry about interlock grip at 5 years old?
No. At this point, I'm just trying to get the right hand below the left hand. If they have a baseball grip, so be it. Yeah. We'll get to that grip later on. But just trying to get the hands in the right position and the feet somewhat spread apart and towards the thing is really all I focus at this age.
Well, it's funny. This summer, we've been teaching a lot of juniors up here, either through the PGA Junior League. We kind of created a fall kids camp.
Yeah.
The players I get up here a lot, girls and boys, is a lot of hockey players, right? That's their sport.
Yeah.
So my biggest thing with the kind of 7 to 10-year-olds is getting to keep their hands together.
Yeah.
Right. Don't worry about the lock, but just not separated. Yeah. And you're trying to explain to an 8-year-old, hey, the reason you don't want to have your right hand too far below your left hand is you're going to start having extra right hand at the bottom of your swing. I've already lost them, right?
Yeah.
Just keep your hands together. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
So I think it's just kind of funny, you know, age-wise, there's so much. Just let them go. Let them go. Have fun. Hit the ball. See what happens.
Yes.
Go find it.
Exactly.
Do it again.
Yes.
So then I'll switch the question to you, Phil, because I see you working with Connor a little bit. I see you work with Laura, but maybe more with Kate. Maybe I just don't see you work with Connor.
Yeah.
Is there certain things that you kind of try to impress on her? Either
at this stage,
I see you working with her putting.
Yeah. No, I know it's great question, and I'm just delighted that you know they're playing, right? And it's like T-Mac, you told me, you know, I know how busy you are with a 5 and a 2-year-old, but it's like, it's you know, if my kids when they started as well were, you know, they liked it, but then you know it was other sports, soccer, baseball, Pop Warner. I mean, all the sports, but they've come back to golf, which is really great. Right. You know, I mean, that I just think you just get so much out of golf, not just people and, you know, and but even business and connections and relationships. It's amazing. So just delighted that they're into that. But now, I used to say to them, like in, you know, mid-teens or whatever, like, they learn how to hit it and then you learn how to play. So I think we're at the point of like, playing now, so you know, even with Kate, it's learning how to score, it's learning how to hit, you know, what the right shot maybe, or to assess, you know, what can go wrong, or or even just where you should hit it, maybe, like, you know, why don't you, like, just think a little bit more about it, and then, you know, because it'll help you shave a few shots off your score, and then just kind of things like alignment and you know, reading a green or something, you know, I need somebody to show me how to read a green these days.
That sounds like it's right up your alley, Sean.
Then you got Connor, who's 6'2" and bombs it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the kids are, you know, they're coordinated, right? Yep. So whether it was field hockey or baseball or stuff, I think that really lends itself to you know, the hand-eye coordination and stuff. So Connor's a big kid, and he's got a good swing, I think, pretty much, and he can, he's like so many kids these days now, they're just hitting it T-Mac so far, right?
Trust me,
but
I
then
know.
it breaks it, it kind of breaks down a little bit then, you know, from around the short game and stuff like that. And it's, it's kind of, I think for me as well, I don't know if it's the same for you guys growing up, but for me, it was easier to figure out the short game growing up and start, you know, starting the game than it was the long game, you know, like, the, you know, I mean, that's where you made your, I think that's where I became a better player with the short game. And it's kind of flipped for me now. I'm probably a better ball striker. Now my short game is not there. You know, or not where, certainly not where it used to be, you know.
Hey, Mac, talk a little bit about that, about kind of what's your strengths. You like short game, you like long game. Where do you feel like you're kind of got good or whatever?
Well, I think as a kid growing up, you know, my grandpa took me to the driving range quite a bit. There wasn't a lot of practice facilities as far as short game went. It was just kind of a field and you hit balls out into it and that was it. So I became a pretty good ball striker, I would say. I hit the ball pretty well. I'd get it around the course pretty well. But my weakness is going to be my short game. And I work very hard on it, but you know, I think it's just one of those things. If I had the time as a younger child to work on those things around the green, I'd be a lot better. But, you know, I think it's just like Phil said, you know, you kind of, what you're able to work with is what your strength becomes, right?
Yeah. So I grew up, I grew up, my dad took me, but my dad, we've talked about it before. My dad was 5'8", maybe about 190 pounds, left-handed, kind of had some like, super bad arthritis, or he was born in 1936, so 1941 in America, like diagnosed with polio, literally. So he really never had strength in his hands and his body to kind of make motions that we can all make, me and my brother. My brother's 6'5", so I always think of him as like, if he had to drive 180 yards, he was super happy. A big deal. You know, we played a lot of par three courses or nine-hole facilities that were kind of maybe par 32 or something. Now I look back, I know why we did, because he didn't want to look. Playing 7,000-yard golf courses.
But that really lended to your short game, though, didn't it?
No, but that playing the par three, which isn't there anymore, Middleton Golf Course that Scott knows as well, but it was an 18-hole par three. And again, I worked at a golf course from the time I was 13 to 21, a course called Thompson Country Club in North Reading. But when I would play with my dad, especially those first kind of like, we'll call it 11, 12, 13 years old, tagging along with my brother, you're hitting three wood from 150 yards. And you are not going to hit the green with a three wood a lot. So you have to become a good short game person. And the guys that, like when I went to clinics, Saturday morning clinics as a 13-year-old, Chris Costa was is an excellent teacher up here in the kind of Northeast area. And then Jane Frost is another lady, excellent LPGA. She's actually, I think she's in the Hall of Fame for LPGA. They were, like Phil said, they happened to be pros at Middleton Golf Course, and they happened to teach Saturday morning clinics, and I still do, and I still teach what they taught me literally 40 years ago.
Holy cow.
That's incredible, Sean.
It's stuff that you kind of don't even realize. I was telling one of the bagroom kids yesterday, I gave a short game lesson. We got a great little chipping practice area back here at Oakley. And the kid's like, why are you so, the bagroom guy's like, why are you so, you're amped up? And I said, because I love teaching chipping. There's so many ways to do it. You chip in Ireland differently than you chip in Massachusetts, differently than you chip in Florida. Like,
this, incredible.
The imagination. All the different things.
And definitely a part of the game that's overlooked completely, right?
Oh, it's so important, and it is over. People, I don't think, spend half enough time on it. I mean, you know,
it brings people to the medium. Like, the reason Tom Kite was Tom Kite was because he was so good with his wedges. You know, like, Lauren Roberts. Who would have ever known Lauren Roberts? But he's an unbelievable putter. Furyk, great putter. Not conventional, but, like, you know.
Incredible putter. You know.
Never going to hit as good as Tiger, as good as Ernie Els, as good as Davis Love. But he figured out Corey Pavin. Like, he, there's players that we can keep talking about that had unbelievable short games, won events. And then, unfortunately, they've kind of gotten outpaced the last 10 to 15 years with Bryson DeChambeau and Dustin Johnson.
Distance. It's changed. It's definitely changed. Distance has definitely changed. But, do you know, Sean, just on that, you're saying, like, do you think the golf swing, you know, we were kind of taught, you know, to kind of hit down on the ball, compress ball, especially links golf as well, because you had to, right? And now it's more, certainly with the driver, it's like they're trying to, like, you're just
swing
supposed
up.
To swing up or try and
Correct.
Swing up.
Correct.
I mean, which is something personally I really, because I think I kind of hit that, still hit down even with the driver,
yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Me, you, and Brandon.
Yeah. Brandon definitely.
Our Instagram video with Tiger just literally 2 days ago, and he's talking about how to hit driver better. And T-Mac, do you remember in my old store, TaylorMade had like a little display of tee height with some of the players?
Yes, I remember that. Yes, yes.
So basically, Rory, Dustin Johnson, these are all TaylorMade guys. Rory, Dustin Johnson, Colin Morikawa. They all use the 3 1/4 inch length tee.
Mm-hmm.
Ricky Fowler are using the 2 1/8 inch tee for driver, because Tiger's point was, I can tee it down lower. I can hit my little butter fade,
yeah.
His little power cut.
Yeah.
He knew what he was going to do every single time. And as soon as you tee it up higher, now it brings into more play some draw components. And he didn't like that.
Yeah.
Know? Like in the US or the British Open with 2 iron, with the trajectory part of it.
That's very interesting. Well, you know what? Sean, at T-Mac last week, there was a kid here, James Amai.
Okay.
And James was in Northwestern. He's a good friend of Connor's, my son.
Okay.
And James is going to Q School this weekend.
Okay.
In, I think he's out in Wisconsin or
okay.
somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And but he played here last week at Oakley, and I played with him, and he was teeing the ball really low.
Yeah.
And I said, like, and he said, because it, I know where it's going when I, he said, it's not going to spray
yeah.
it left or right
yeah.
when I'm teeing it low. And I was like, what are you talking about?
It eliminates know? It eliminates a lot of negative bad things.
Yeah. I didn't. Yeah.
Why don't we tell you something?
There you go.
Well, it's a lot more controlled shot pattern, right? You know, it's much more natural for us to kind of swing onto the inside than it is to the left and then try to manipulate the face to bring it back around, right? So you can kind of tee it down
yeah.
a little bit lower, cut it out there. And for me, when I'm on a tight hole or I've got water, you know, on one side or the other, that's what I'm doing. I'm teeing it down a little bit, and I'm trying to hit it more in the heel than I am out towards the toe, for sure.
Wow.
So what was Daly's whole mantra when he came out on the golf, like when he came out on tour? His whole thing was tee it high, let it fly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He, first one, realistically, who came out with that physique and that attitude. I mean, Palmer and kind of some of these guys had sort of that bruising attitude, but he was the guy who came up to the range, had a cigarette in his mouth.
Yeah.
Hit three. I saw him at Doral. I saw him in Miami at Doral. And he had to go from one corner of the range to the other opposite corner.
Wow.
He took a cigarette, went back to the putting green, hit three putts, and went to the first tee. Right? But he was the guy. He was the tee it high, let it fly guy.
But there again, you're talking about the technology. The technology now has gotten so much more advanced that you can play a cut and it'll go just as long as John Daly's big draw back then.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, true.
Yeah. You know, and the golf ball's really juiced too.
Yeah, Everything is T-Mac.
Hey, this has been great, T-Mac. We, like I said, with each one of these guys, I know we could do a follow up episode, right?
Mm-hmm. I love it.
This is good stuff. This is what we want for our listeners. So, Phil, hope you enjoyed it.
Really enjoyed it. Yeah. Nice to chat with you, T-Mac, Sean.
Yeah.
Yes.
Always good to chat.
Yeah.
Glad to do it. And thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. We really appreciate you coming on to the Dynamic Podcast Show. We really appreciate it. This has been very interesting. So I'm super excited. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, T-Mac. Thanks, guys.
All right, T-Mac.
Have a good one.
We'll see you soon. Listeners, we'll talk to you next time.